I just had the most fantastically awful date, and you have to have a drink with me. Snowflakes gathered in the dark waves of her hair. Her sweet scattering of freckles glowed. Her cheeks were bright pink, as if someone had double-slapped her. She has this great voice, this fuzzy duckling voice, that starts out ridiculously cute and ends up completely sexy. Please, Nick, I've got to get that bad date taste out of my mouth. I remember us laughing and thinking what a relief it was to be with a woman and hear her laugh. She was wearing jeans and a cashmere V-neck. She is one of those girls who look better in jeans than a dress. Her face, her body, is casual in the best way. I assumed my position behind the bar, and she slid onto a bar stool, her eyes assessing all the liquor bottles behind me. "What do you want, lady?"
"Surprise me," she said.
"Boo," I said, the word leaving my lips kiss-puckered.
"Now surprise me with a drink."
She leaned forward so her cleavage was leveraged against the bar, her breasts pushed upward. She wore a pendant on a thin gold chain. The pendant slid between her breasts down under her sweater. "Don't be that guy," I thought. "The guy who pants over where the pendant ends." "What flavor you feel like?" I asked.
"Whatever you give me, I'll like."
It was that line that caught me, the simplicity of it. The idea that I could do something and it would make a woman happy and it would be easy. "Whatever you give me, I'll like." I felt an overwhelming wave of relief. And then I knew I didn't love Amy anymore. "I don't love my wife anymore," I thought, turning to grab two tumblers. "Not even a little bit. I am wiped clean of love. I am spotless." I made my favorite drink. Christmas morning, hot coffee and cold peppermint schnapps. I had one with her, and when she shivered and laughed, that big whoop of a laugh, I poured us another round. We drank together an hour past closing time, and I mentioned the word wife 3 times, because I was looking at Andy and picturing taking her clothes off. A warning for her, the least I could do. I have a wife. Do with that what you will. She sat in front of me, her chin in her hands, smiling up at me.
"Walk me home," she said.
She'd mentioned before how close she lived to downtown, how she needed to stop by the bar some night and say hello. And did she mention how close she lived to the bar? My mind had been primed. Many times I'd mentally strolled the few blocks toward the bland brick apartments where she lived. So when I suddenly was out the door, walking her home, it didn't seem unusual at all. There wasn't that warning bell that told me, "This is unusual. This is not what we do." I walked her home, against the wind, snow flying everywhere, helping her rewrap her red knitted scarf. Once, twice, and on the third time, I was tucking her in properly, and our faces were close, and her cheeks were a merry holiday sledding pink, and it was the kind of thing that could never have happened in another 100 nights. But that night it was possible. The conversation, the booze, the storm, the scarf. We grabbed each other at the same time, me pushing her up against a tree for better leverage, the spindly branches dumping a pile of snow on us, a stunning, comical moment that only made me more insistent on touching her, touching everything at once, one hand up inside her sweater, the other between her legs, and her letting me. She pulled back from me, her teeth chattering.
Come up with me.
I paused.
Come up with me, she said again. I want to be with you.
The sex wasn't that great, not the first time. We were two bodies used to different rhythms, never quite getting the hang of each other, and it had been so long since I'd been inside a woman. I came first, quickly, and kept moving 30 crucial seconds as I began wilting inside her, just long enough to get her taken care of before I went entirely slack. So it was nice, but disappointing, anticlimactic, the way girls must feel when they give up their virginity. That was what all the fuss was about? But I liked how she wrapped herself around me, and I liked that she was as soft as I'd imagined. New skin. Young, I thought disgracefully, picturing Amy and her constant lotioning, sitting in bed and slapping away at herself angrily. I went into Andy's bathroom, took a piss, looked at myself in the mirror, and made myself say it. You are a cheater. You have failed one of the most basic male tests. You are not a good man. And when that didn't bother me, I thought, you're really not a good man. The horrifying thing was, if the sex had been outrageously mind-blowing, that might have been my sole indiscretion. But it was only decent, and now I was a cheater, and I couldn't ruin my record of fidelity on something merely average, so I knew there would be a next. I didn't promise myself never again. And then the next was very, very good. And the next after that was great. Soon Andy became a physical counterpoint to all things Amy. She laughed with me and made me laugh. She didn't immediately contradict me or second-guess me. She never scowled at me. She was easy. It was all so fucking easy. And I thought, love makes you want to be a better man. Right, right. But maybe love, real love, also gives you permission to just be the man you are. I was going to tell Amy. I knew it had to happen. I continued not to tell Amy for months and months, and then more months. Most of it was cowardice. I couldn't bear to have the conversation, to have to explain myself. I couldn't imagine having to discuss the divorce with Rand and Mary Beth, as they certainly would insert themselves into the fray. But part of it, in truth, was my strong streak of pragmatism. It was almost grotesque how practical, self-serving, I could be. I hadn't asked Amy for a divorce, in part, because Amy's money had financed the bar. She basically owned it. She would certainly take it back. And I couldn't bear to look at my twin trying to be brave as she lost another couple years of her life. So I let myself drift on in the miserable situation, assuming that at some point Amy would take charge, Amy would demand a divorce, and then I would get to be the good guy. This desire to escape the situation without blame was despicable. The more despicable I became, the more I craved Andy, who knew that I wasn't as bad as I seemed if my story were published in the paper for strangers to read. Amy will divorce you, I kept thinking. She can't let it linger on much longer. But as spring faded away and summer came, then fall, then winter, and I became a cheating man of all seasons, a cheat with a pleasantly impatient mistress, it became clear that something would have to be done.
I mean, I love you, Nick, Andy said,
here, surreally, on my sister's sofa.
No matter what happens, I don't really know what else to say. I feel pretty...
She threw her hands up.
Stupid.
Don't feel stupid, I said. I don't know what to say either. There's nothing to say.
You can say that you love me no matter what happens.
I thought, I can't say that out loud anymore. I'd said it once or twice, a spitty mumble against her neck, homesick for something. But the words were out there, and so was a lot more. I thought then of the trail we'd left, our busy, semi-hidden love affair that I hadn't worried enough about. If her building had a security camera, I was on it. I'd bought a disposable phone just for her calls, but those voicemails and texts went to her very permanent cell. I'd written her a dirty Valentine that I could already see splashed across the news, me rhyming besought with twat. And more, Andy was 23. I assumed my words, my voice, even photos of me were captured on various electronica. I'd flipped through the photos on her phone one night, jealous, possessive, curious, and seen plenty of shots of an ex or two smiling proudly in her bed, and I assumed at one point I'd joined the club. I kind of wanted to join the club, and for some reason that hadn't worried me, even though it could be downloaded and sent to a million people in the space of a vengeful second. This is an extremely weird situation, Andy. I just need you to be patient. She pulled back from me.
You can't say you love me, no matter what happens?
I love you, Andy, I do. I held her eyes. Saying I love you was dangerous right now, but so was not saying it.
Fuck me then,
she whispered. She began tugging at my belt. We have to be real careful right now. It's a bad, bad place for me if the police find out about us. It looks beyond bad.
That's what you're worried about?
I'm a man with a missing wife and a secret girlfriend. Yeah, it looks bad. It looks criminal.
That makes it sound sleazy.
Her breasts were still out. People don't know us, Andy. They will think it's sleazy.
God, it's like some bad noir movie.
I smiled. I'd introduced Andy to noir, to Bogart and The Big Sleep, Double Indemnity, all the classics. It was one of the things I liked best about us, that I could show her things.
Why don't we just tell the police?
She said.
Wouldn't that be better?
No. Andy, don't even think about it. No.
They're going to find out.
Why? Why would they? Have you told anyone about us, sweetheart? She gave me a twitchy look. I felt bad. This was not how she thought the night would go. She had been excited to see me. She had been imagining a lusty reunion, physical reassurance, and I was busy covering my ass. Sweetheart, I'm sorry. I just need to know, I said.
Not by name.
What do you mean, not by name?
I mean,
she said, pulling up her dress finally.
My friends, my mom, they know I'm seeing someone, but not by name.
And not by any kind of description, right? I said it more urgently than I wanted to, feeling like I was holding up a collapsing ceiling. Two people know about this, Andy. You and me. If you help me, if you love me, it will just be us knowing, and then the police will never find out. She traced a finger along my jawline.
And what if they never find Amy?
You and I, Andy, will be together no matter what happens. But only if we're careful. If we're not careful, it's possible it looks bad enough that I could go to prison.
Maybe she ran off with someone, she said, leaning her cheek against my shoulder. Maybe...
I could feel her girl brain buzzing, turning Amy's disappearance into a frothy, scandalous romance, ignoring any reality that didn't suit the narrative. She didn't run off. It's much more serious than that. I put a finger under her chin so she looked at me. Andy, I need you to take this very seriously, okay?
Of course I'm taking it seriously, but I need to be able to talk to you more often, to see you. I'm freaking out, Nick.
We just need to sit tight for now. I gripped both her shoulders so she had to look at me. My wife is missing, Andy.
But you don't even...
I knew what she was about to say. You don't even love her. But she was smart enough to stop. She put her arms around me.
Look, I don't want to fight. I know you care about Amy, and I know you must be really worried. I am too. I know you are under... I can't imagine the pressure. So I'm fine keeping an even lower profile than I did before, if that's possible. But remember, this affects me too. I need to hear from you. Once a day. Just call when you can, even if it's only for a few seconds, so I can hear your voice. Once a day, Nick. Every single day. I'll go crazy otherwise. I'll go crazy.
She smiled at me, whispered,
"Now kiss me."
I kissed her very softly.
"I love you," she said,
and I kissed her neck and mumbled my reply. We sat in silence, the TV flickering. I let my eyes close. "Now kiss me." Who had said that? I lurched awake just after 5 a.m. Go was up. I could hear her down the hall, running water in the bathroom. I shook Andy. "It's 5 a.m. It's 5 a.m. And with promises of love and phone calls, I hustled her toward the door like a shameful one-nighter.
"Remember, call every day," Andy whispered.
I heard the bathroom door open. "Every day," I said, and ducked behind the door as I opened it, and Andy left. When I turned back around, Go was standing in the living room. Her mouth had dropped open, stunned, but the rest of her body was in full fury, hands on hips, eyebrows V'd.
"Nick, you fucking idiot."
Amy Elliott Dunn, July 21st, 2011. Diary entry. I am such an idiot. Sometimes I look at myself and I think, no wonder Nick finds me ridiculous, frivolous, spoiled compared to his mom. Maureen is dying. She hides her disease behind big smiles and roomy embroidered sweatshirts, answering every question about her health with, "Oh, I'm just fine, but how are you doing, sweetie?" She is dying, but she is not going to admit it. Not yet. So yesterday, she phones me in the morning, asks me if I want to go on a field trip with her and her friends. She is having a good day. She wants to get out of the house as much as she can. And I agree immediately, even though I knew they'd be doing nothing that particularly interested me. Pinochle, bridge, some church activity that usually requires sorting things. "We'll be there in 15 minutes," she says. "Wear short sleeves." Cleaning. It had to be cleaning. something requiring elbow grease. I throw on a short-sleeve shirt, and in exactly 15 minutes, I am opening the door to Maureen, bald under a knitted cap, giggling with her two friends. They are all wearing matching appliqued T-shirts, all bells and ribbons, with the words, "The Plaz Mamas," airbrushed across their chests. I think they've started a doo-wop group. But then we all climb into Rose's old Chrysler. Old, old. One of those where the front seat goes all the way across. A grandmotherly car that smells of ladies' cigarettes. And off we merrily go to the Plasma Donation Center. "We're Mondays and Thursdays," Rose explains, looking at me in the rear view. "Oh," I say. How else does one reply? "Oh, those are awesome plasma days." "You're allowed to give twice a week," says Maureen, the bells on her sweatshirt jingling. "The first time you get $20, the second time you get $30. That's why everyone's in such a good mood today." "You'll love it," Vicky says. "Everyone just sits and chats, like a beauty salon." Maureen squeezes my arm and says quietly, "I can't give any more, but I thought you could be my proxy. It might be a nice way for you to get some pin money. It's good for a girl to have a little cash of her own." I swallow a quick gust of anger. "I used to have more than a little cash of my own, but I gave it to your son." A scrawny man in an undersized jean jacket hangs around the parking lot like a stray dog. Inside, though, the place is clean, well-lit, piney-smelling, with Christian posters on the wall, all doves and mist. But I know I can't do it. Needles, blood, I can't do either. I don't really have any other phobias, but those two are solid. I am the girl who swoons at a paper cut. Something about the opening of skin, peeling, slicing, piercing. During chemo with Maureen, I never looked when they put in the needle. "Hi, Kaylee's," Maureen calls out as we enter, and a heavy black woman in a vaguely medical uniform calls back, "Hi there, Maureen. How you feeling?" "Oh, I'm fine, just fine. But how are you?" "How long have you been doing this?" I ask. "A while," Maureen says. "Kay Lise is everyone's favorite. She gets the needle in real smooth, which was always good for me because I have rollers." She proffers her forearm with its ropey blue veins. When I first met Mo, she was fat, but no more. It's odd. She actually looks better fat. "See? Try to put your finger on one." I look around, hoping Kaylise is going to usher us in. "Go on, try." I touch a fingertip to the vein and feel it roll out from under. A rush of heat overtakes me.
"So, is this our new recruit?"
Kaylise asks, suddenly beside me.
"Maureen brags on you all the time. So, we'll need you to fill out some paperwork."
"I'm sorry, I can't. I can't do needles, I can't do blood. I have a serious phobia. I literally can't do it." I realize I haven't eaten today, and a wave of wooziness hits me. My neck feels weak.
"Everything here is very hygienic. You're in very good hands," Kaylee says.
"No, it's not that, truly. I've never given blood. My doctor gets angry at me because I can't even handle a yearly blood test for, like, cholesterol." Instead, we wait. It takes 2 hours, Vicky and Rose strapped to churning machines, like they are being harvested. They've even been branded on their fingers, so they can't give more than twice in a week anywhere. The marks show up under a purple light.
"That's the James Bond part," Vicky says. And they all giggle.
Maureen hums the Bond theme song, I think, and Rose makes a gun with her fingers.
"Can't you old biddies keep it down for once? calls a white-haired woman four chairs down. She leans up over the reclined bodies of three oily men, green-blue tattoos on their arms, stubble on their chins, the kind of men I pictured donating plasma, and gives a finger wave with her loose arm.
Mary, I thought you were coming tomorrow.
I was, but my unemployment doesn't come for a week, and I was down to a box of cereal and a can of creamed corn.
They all laugh like near starvation is amusing. This town is sometimes too much, so desperate and so in denial. I begin to feel ill. The sound of blood churning, the long plastic ribbons of blood coursing from bodies to machines, the people being, what, being farmed. Blood everywhere I look, out in the open, where blood isn't supposed to be, deep and dark, almost purple. I get up to go to the bathroom, throw cold water on my face. I take two steps, and my ears close up, my vision pinholes. I feel my own heartbeat, my own blood, and as I fall, I say, "Oh, sorry." I barely remember the ride home. Maureen tucks me into bed, a glass of apple juice, a bowl of soup at the bedside. We try to call Nick. Go says he's not at the bar, and he doesn't pick up his cell. The man disappears.
"He was like that as a boy, too. He's a wanderer," Maureen says. "Worst thing you could ever do is ground him to his room."
She positions a cool washcloth on my forehead. Her breath has the tangy smell of aspirin.
"Your job is to rest, okay? I'll keep calling till I get that boy home."
When Nick gets home, I'm asleep. I wake up to hear him taking a shower, and I check the time. 11:04 p.m. He must have gone by the bar after all. He likes to shower after a shift, get the beer and salty popcorn smell off his skin. He says. He slips into bed, and when I turn to him with open eyes, he looks dismayed I'm awake.
"We've been trying to reach you for hours," I say.
"My phone was out of juice. You fainted?"
"I thought you said your phone was out of juice."
He pauses, and I know he is about to lie. The worst feeling? When you just have to wait and prepare yourself for the lie. Nick is old-fashioned. He needs his freedom. He doesn't like to explain himself. He'll know he has plans with the guys for a week, and he'll still wait until an hour before the poker game to tell me nonchalantly,
"Hey, so I thought I'd join the guys for poker tonight, if that's okay with you."
And leave me to be the bad guy if I've made other plans. You don't ever want to be the wife who keeps her husband from playing poker. You don't want to be the shrew with the hair curlers and the rolling pin. So you swallow your disappointment and say, "Okay." I don't think he does this to be mean. It's just how he was raised. His dad did his own thing, always, and his mom put up with it. Until she divorced him. He begins his lie. I don't even listen.
Nick Dunn. 5 days gone. I leaned against the door, staring at my sister. I could still smell Andy, and I wanted that moment to myself for 1 second, because now that she was gone, I could enjoy the idea of her. She always tasted like butterscotch and smelled like lavender. Lavender shampoo, lavender lotion. "Lavender's for luck," she explained to me once. I'd need luck. "How old is she?" Go was demanding, hands on hips. "That's where you want to start?" "How old is she, Nick?" 23.
Brilliant.
Go, don't...
Nick, do you not realize how fucked you are?
Go said.
Fucked and dumb.
She made dumb a kid's word, hit me as hard as if I were a 10-year-old again. It's not an ideal situation, I allowed, my voice quiet.
Ideal situation? You're a cheater, Nick. I mean, what happened to you? You were always one of the good guys. Or have I just been an idiot all along?
No. I stared at the floor, at the same spot I stared at as a kid when my mom sat me down on the sofa and told me I was better than whatever I'd just done.
Now? You're a man who cheats on his wife. You can't ever undo that,
Go said.
God, even Dad didn't cheat. Your wife is missing. Amy's who knows where, and you're here making time with a little...
Go, I enjoy this revisionist history in which you're Amy's champion. I mean, you never liked Amy, not even early on. And since all this happened, it's like
I have sympathy for your missing wife. Yeah, Nick. I have concern. Yeah, I do. Remember how before, when I said you were being weird? It's insane, the way you're acting.
She paced the room, chewing a thumbnail.
The police find out about this, and I just don't even know,
she said.
I'm fucking scared, Nick. This is the first time I'm really scared for you. I can't believe they haven't found out yet. They must have pulled your phone records.
I used a disposable. She paused at that.
That's even worse. That's like premeditation.
Premeditated cheating, Go? Yes, I am guilty of that. She succumbed for a second, collapsed on the sofa, the new reality settling on her. In truth, I was relieved that Go knew.
How long?
She asked. A little over a year. I made myself pull my eyes from the floor and look at her directly.
Over a year? And you never told me.
I was afraid you'd tell me to stop, that you'd think badly of me and then I'd have to stop. And I didn't want to. Things with Amy.
Over a year,
Go said.
And I never even guessed. 8,000 drunk conversations, and you never trusted me enough to tell me. I didn't know you could do that. Keep something from me that totally.
That's the only thing. Go shrugged. How can I believe you now?
You love her?
She gave it a jokey spin to show how unlikely it was. Yeah, I really think I do. I did. I do.
You do realize that if you actually dated her, saw her on a regular basis, lived with her, that she would find some fault with you, right? That she would find some things about you that drove her crazy, that she'd make demands of you that you wouldn't like, that she'd get angry at you?
I'm not 10, Go. I know how relationships work. She shrugged again. Do you?
We need a lawyer, she said. A good lawyer with some PR skills, because the networks, some cable shows, they're sniffing around. We need to make sure the media doesn't turn you into the evil, philandering husband, because if that happens, I just think it's all over.
Go, you're sounding a little drastic. I actually agreed with her, but I couldn't bear to hear the words aloud from Go. I had to discredit them.
Nick, this is a little drastic. I'm going to make some calls.
Whatever you want, if it makes you feel better. Go jabbed me in the sternum with two hard fingers.
Don't you fucking pull that with me, Lance. Oh, girls get so overexcited. That's bullshit. You are in a really bad place, my friend. Get your head out of your ass and start helping me fix this.
Beneath my shirt, I could feel the spot embering on my skin as Go turned away from me and, thank God, went back to her room. I sat on her couch, numb. Then I lay down as I promised myself I'd get up. I dreamed of Amy. She was crawling across our kitchen floor, hands and knees, trying to make it to the back door. But she was blind from the blood, and she was moving so slowly, too slowly. Her pretty head was strangely misshapen, dented in on the right side. Blood was dripping from one long hank of hair, and she was moaning my name. I woke and knew it was time to go home. I needed to see the place, the scene of the crime. I needed to face it. No one was out in the heat. Our neighborhood was as vacant and lonely as the day Amy disappeared. I stepped inside my front door and made myself breathe. Weird that a house so new could feel haunted, and not in the romantic Victorian novel way, just really gruesomely, shittily ruined. A house with a history, and it was only 3 years old. The lab technicians had been all over the place. Surfaces were smeared and sticky and smudged. I sat down on the sofa, and it smelled like someone, like an actual person, with a stranger's scent, a spicy aftershave. I opened the windows despite the heat, get in some air. Bleeker trotted down the stairs, and I picked him up and petted him while he purred. Someone, some cop, had overfilled his bowl for me. A nice gesture after dismantling my home. I set him down carefully on the bottom step, then climbed up to the bedroom, unbuttoning my shirt. I lay down across the bed and put my face in the pillow, the same navy blue pillowcase I'd stared into the morning of our anniversary, the morning of. My phone rang. Go. I picked up. Ellen Abbott is doing a special noonday show. It's about Amy. You. It doesn't look good. You want me to come over? No, I can watch it alone. Thanks. We both hovered on the line, waiting for the other to apologize. Okay, let's talk after, Go said. Ellen Abbott Live was a cable show specializing in missing, murdered women, starring the permanently furious Ellen Abbott, a former prosecutor and victims' rights advocate. The show opened with Ellen, blow-dried and lip-glossed, glaring at the camera. A shocking story to report today. A beautiful young woman who was the inspiration for the Amazing Amy book series. Missing. House torn apart. Hubby is Lance Nicholas Dunn, an unemployed writer who now owns a bar he bought with his wife's money. Want to know how worried he is? These are photos taken since his wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, went missing July 5th, their five-year anniversary. Cut to the photo of me at the press conference, the jackass grin. Another of me waving and smiling like a pageant queen as I got out of my car. I was waving back to Mary Beth. I was smiling because I smile when I wave. Then up came the cell phone photo of me and Shauna Kelly, Frito Pie Baker. The two of us, cheek to cheek, beaming pearly whites. Then the real Shauna appeared on screen, tanned and sculpted and somber as Ellen introduced her to America. Pinpricks of sweat erupted all over me. Ellen.
So, Lance Nicholas Dunn. Can you describe his demeanor for us, Shauna? You meet him as everyone is out searching for his missing wife, and Lance Nicholas Dunn is... what?
Shauna.
He was very calm, very friendly.
Ellen.
Excuse me? Excuse me? He was friendly and calm? His wife is missing, Shauna. What kind of man is friendly and calm?
The grotesque photo appeared on screen again. We somehow looked even more cheerful. Shauna.
He was actually a little flirty.
You should have been nicer to her, Nick. You should have eaten the fucking pie. Ellen.
Flirty? While his wife is God knows where, and Lance Dunn is... Well, I'm sorry, Shauna, but this photo is just... I don't know a better word than disgusting. This is not how an innocent man looks.
The rest of the segment was basically Ellen Abbott, professional hate-monger, obsessing over my lack of alibi.
Why doesn't Lance Nicholas Dunn have an alibi until noon? Where was he that morning?
She drawled in her Texas sheriff's accent. Her panel of guests agreed that it didn't look good. I phoned Go and she said, "Well, you made it almost a week without them turning on you." And we cursed for a while.
Fucking Shauna, crazy bitch whore. Do something really, really useful today. Active,
Go advised.
People will be watching now.
I couldn't sit still if I wanted to. I drove to St. Louis in a near rage, replaying the TV segment in my head, answering all of Ellen's questions, shutting her up.
Today, Ellen Abbott, you fucking cunt, I tracked down one of Amy's stalkers, Desi Callings. I tracked him down to get the truth.
Me, the hero husband. If I had soaring theme music, I would have played it. Me, the nice working-class guy, taking on the spoiled rich kid. The media would have to bite at that. Obsessive stalkers are more intriguing than run-of-the-mill wife killers. The Elliots, at least, would appreciate it. I dialed Mary Beth, but just got voicemail. Onward. As I rolled into his neighborhood, I had to change my Desi vision from rich to extremely sickly wealthy. The guy lived in a mansion in Ladue that probably cost at least $5 million. Whitewashed brick, black lacquer shutters, gaslight, and ivy. I'd dressed for the meeting, a decent suit and tie, but I realized as I rang his doorbell that a $400 suit in this neighborhood was more poignant than if I'd shown up in jeans. I could hear a clattering of dress shoes coming from the back of the house to the front, and the door opened with a desuctioning sound like a refrigerator. Cold air rolled out toward me. Desi looked the way I had always wanted to look, like a very handsome, very decent fellow. Something in the eyes, or the jaw. He had deep-set almond eyes, teddy bear eyes, and dimples in both cheeks. If you saw the two of us together, you'd assume he was the good guy.
Oh,
Desi said, studying my face.
You're Nick. Nick Dunn.
Good God, I'm so sorry about Amy.
Come in. Come in.
He ushered me into a severe living room, manliness as envisioned by a decorator. Lots of dark, uncomfortable leather. He pointed me toward an armchair with a particularly rigid back. I tried to make myself comfortable, as urged, but found the only posture the chair allowed was that of a chastised student.
Pay attention and sit up.
Desi didn't ask me why I was in his living room, or explain how he'd immediately recognized me. Although they were becoming more common, the double takes and cupped whispers.
May I get you a drink?
Desi asked, pressing two hands together. Business first. I'm fine. He sat down opposite me. He was dressed in impeccable shades of navy and cream. Even his shoelaces looked pressed. He carried it all off, though. He wasn't the dismissible fop I'd been hoping for. Desi seemed the definition of a gentleman, a guy who could quote a great poet, order a rare scotch, and buy a woman the right piece of vintage jewelry. He seemed, in fact, a man who knew inherently what women wanted. Across from him, I felt my suit wilt, my manner go clumsy. I had a swelling urge to discuss football and fart. These were the kinds of guys who always got to me.
Amy, any leads?
Desi asked. He looked like someone familiar, an actor maybe. No good ones.
She was taken from the home, is that correct?
From our home, yes. Then I knew who he was. He was the guy who'd shown up alone the first day of searches, the guy who kept sneaking looks at Amy's photo. You were at the volunteer center, weren't you? The first day.
I was, Desi said, reasonable. I was about to say that. I wish I'd been able to meet you that day, express my condolences.
Long way to come.
I could say the same to you.
He smiled.
Look, I'm really fond of Amy. Hearing what had happened, well, I had to do something. It's terrible to say this, Nick, but when I saw it on the news, I just thought, of course.
Of course?
Of course someone would want her, he said.
He had a deep voice. A fireside voice.
You know, she always had that way. Of making people want her. Always. You know that old cliché, men want her and women want to be her. With Amy, that was true.
Desi folded large hands across his trousers. Not pants, trousers. I couldn't decide if he was fucking with me. I told myself to tread lightly. It's the rule of all potentially prickly interviews. Don't go on the offense until you have to. First, see if they'll hang themselves all on their own. You had a very intense relationship with Amy, right? I asked.
It wasn't only her looks, Desi said.
He leaned on a knee, his eyes distant.
I've thought about this a lot, of course. First love? I've definitely thought about it. The navel gazer in me. Too much philosophy.
He cracked a self-effacing grin. The dimples popped.
See, when Amy likes you, when she's interested in you, her attention is so warm and reassuring and entirely enveloping, like a warm bath.
I raised my eyebrows.
Bear with me, he said. You feel good about yourself, completely good, for maybe the first time. And then she sees your flaws. She realizes you're just another regular person she has to deal with. You are, in actuality, Abel Andy, and in real life, Abel Andy would never make it with Amazing Amy. So her interest fades, and you stop feeling good. You can feel that old coldness again, like you're naked on the bathroom floor. And all you want
is to get back in the bath. I knew that feeling. I'd been on the bathroom floor for about 3 years, and I felt a rush of disgust for sharing this emotion with this other man.
I'm sure you know what I mean, Desi said, and smiled winkily at me.
What an odd man, I thought. Who compares another man's wife to a bath he wants to sink into? Another man's missing wife.
Behind Desi was a long, polished end table bearing several silver-framed photos. In the center was an oversized one of Desi and Amy back in high school, in tennis whites, the two so preposterously stylish, so moneyed lush, they could have been a frame from a Hitchcock movie. I pictured Desi, teenage Desi, slipping into Amy's dorm room, dropping his clothes to the floor, settling onto the cold sheets, swallowing plastic-coated pills, waiting to be found. It was a form of punishment, of rage, but not the kind that occurred in my house. I could see why the police weren't that interested. Desi trailed my glance.
Oh, well, you can't blame me for that. He smiled. I mean, would you throw away a photo that perfect?
Of a girl I hadn't known for 20 years? I said before I could stop. I realized my tone sounded more aggressive than was wise.
I know Amy, Desi snapped.
He took a breath.
I knew her. I knew her very well. There aren't any leads? I have to ask. Her father, is he there?
Of course he is.
I don't suppose he was definitely in New York when it happened?
He was in New York. Why? Desi shrugged. Just curious, no reason. We sat in silence for a half minute, playing a game of eye contact chicken. Neither of us blinked. I actually came here, Desi, to see what you could tell me. I tried again to picture Desi making off with Amy. Did he have a lake house somewhere nearby? All these types did. Would it be believable, this refined, sophisticated man keeping Amy in some preppy basement rec room? Amy pacing the carpet, sleeping on a dusty sofa in some bright, clubby 60s color, lemon, yellow, or coral? I wished Boney and Gilpin were here, had witnessed the proprietary tone of Desi's voice. I know Amy.
Me?
Desi laughed. He laughed richly. The perfect phrase to describe the sound.
I can't tell you anything. Like you said, I don't know her.
But you just said you did.
I certainly don't know her like you know her.
You stalked her in high school.
I stalked her? Nick, she was my girlfriend.
Until she wasn't, I said. And you wouldn't go away.
Oh, I probably did pine for her, but nothing out of the ordinary.
You call trying to kill yourself in her dorm room ordinary? He jerked his head, squinted his eyes. He opened his mouth to speak, then stared down at his hands.
I'm not sure what you're talking about, Nick, he finally said.
I'm talking about you stalking my wife. In high school. Now.
That's really what this is about?
He laughed again.
Good God, I thought you were raising money for a reward fund or something, which I'm happy to cover, by the way. Like I said, I've never stopped wanting the best for Amy. Do I love her? No. I don't know her anymore, not really. We exchange the occasional letter, but it is interesting you coming here, you confusing the issue. Because I have to tell you, Nick, on TV, hell, here, now, you don't seem to be a grieving, worried husband. You seem smug. The police, by the way, already talked with me, thanks, I guess, to you. Or Amy's parents. Strange you didn't know. You'd think they'd tell the husband everything if he were in the clear. My stomach clenched. I'm here because I wanted to see for myself your face when you talked about Amy, I said. I gotta tell you, it worries me. You get a little moony.
One of us has to, Desi said, again reasonably.
Sweetheart? A voice came from the back of the house, and another set of expensive shoes clattered toward the living room. What was the name of that book? The woman was a blurry vision of Amy. Amy in a steam-fogged mirror. Exact coloring, extremely similar features, but a quarter century older. The flesh, the features, all let out a bit, like a fine fabric. She was still gorgeous, a woman who chose to age gracefully. She was shaped like some sort of origami creation, elbows in extreme points, a clothes hanger collarbone. She wore a china blue sheath dress and had the same pull Amy did. When she was in a room, you kept turning your head back her way. She gave me a rather predatory smile. Hello, I'm Jacqueline Callings.
Mother, this is Amy's husband, Nick, Desi said.
Amy. The woman smiled again. She had a bottom-of-a-well voice, deep and strangely resonant.
We've been quite interested in that story around here.
Yes, very interested. She turned coldly to her son.
We can never stop thinking about the superb Amy Elliott, can we?
Amy Dunn now, I said.
Of course, Jacqueline agreed. I'm so sorry, Nick, for what you're going through.
She stared at me a moment.
I'm sorry, I must... I didn't picture Amy with such an... American boy.
She seemed to be speaking neither to me nor to Desi.
Good God, he even has a cleft chin.
I came over to see if your son had any information, I said. I know he's written my wife a lot of letters over the years.
Oh, the letters!
Jacqueline smiled angrily.
Such an interesting way to spend one's time, don't you think?
Amy shared them with you? Desi asked. I'm surprised.
No, I said, turning to him. She threw them away unopened, always.
All of them? Always? You know that?
Desi said, still smiling. Once I went through the trash to read one. I turned back to Jacqueline. Just to see what exactly was going on.
Good for you, Jacqueline said, purring at me. I'd expect nothing less of my husband.
Amy and I always wrote each other letters, Desi said.
He had his mother's cadence, the delivery that indicated everything he said was something you'd want to hear.
It was our thing. I find emails so cheap, and no one saves them. No one saves an email because it's so inherently impersonal. I worry about posterity in general. All the great love letters, from Simone de Beauvoir to Sartre, from Samuel Clemens to his wife Olivia. I don't know, I always think about what will be lost.
Have you kept all my letters? Jacqueline asked. She was standing at the fireplace, looking down on us, one long, sinewy arm trailing along the mantelpiece.
Of course.
She turned to me with an elegant shrug.
Just curious.
I shivered, was about to reach out toward the fireplace for warmth, but remembered that it was July,
It seems to me a rather strange devotion to keep up all these years, I said. I mean, she didn't write you back.